The taste of place, otherwise known as terroir.
What really defines terroir to me is it doesn't have to just be what you might call the, you know, the chemical definition of terroir, like the different compounds in the earth that are affecting flavor, but anything that a place on earth is doing that is giving a cue to the plant itself or to the people growing the plant about what they should be doing to draw out the greatest flavor possible should count as terroir.
That's Rowan Jacobson. We'll talk with him in the second half of the show about his book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. But first, we talk with Amanda Copeland about her debut novel, The Orchardist. It weaves a deeply evocative story of character and place.
A lot of people have said that this book is really dark, and I understand and I recognize that darkness, but, you know, I also hope that people appreciate, you know, the moments where the bright moments of the book come from, you know, those moments of real communication between the characters and the relationship between the characters and either a passion that they have or the landscape itself.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Amanda Copeland's novel, The Orchardist, is getting a lot of buzz, especially for a debut novel. It was listed in Publishers Weekly's Top 10 Literary Fiction of the Season and O Magazine's 10 Titles to Pick Up. Set in the apple-growing region of Washington State around the turn of the last century, the novel tells the story of a kind of accidental family that's formed when the orchardist of the title, a solitary man named Talmage, discovers two young women stealing apples from his trees. They're wild-looking and unkempt, and they're both pregnant. It turns out they've escaped from a situation of unspeakable abuse. Talmage takes them in, and, in caring for them and their offspring, begins a journey to heal deep wounds rooted in his own past. The Orchardist deals with the themes of trauma and healing, and the deep balm brought about by the connection between humans and nature. It's a novel of great compassion and power, all the more striking for a literary debut. Amanda Copeland was born in Wenatchee, Washington. She lives in Portland, Oregon, with her partner, a forestry ecologist who, she says, helped with all the trees in the book. Amanda Copeland, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is an extraordinary novel, not just for any novelist, I think, but especially for a debut novelist. First of all, before we go any further, I think our listeners will want to know the broad outlines of the plot. So tell us what's going on in this novel.
Well, the novel is about sort of on a plot level. It's about a man named William Talmage who, at the beginning of the book, we see him, you know, when he's in his early 50s, and he's lived most of his life by himself, sort of up in the foothills of the Cascade Range, tending to his orchards. And the novel begins when he encounters two young pregnant girls who come into his property. And so the novel is about sort of their relationship and what happens throughout the rest of their lives.
And this is taking place at the turn of the
last century.
And it's a really striking environment, one that you yourself are very familiar with because you grew up in rural Washington. Tell us a little bit about this, the terrain.
Well, when I was growing up, this was in the 80s. This was a time, you know, where Washington was then and still is, you know, central Washington is this mass producer of produce, you know, being apples primarily and pears and cherries and a whole range of other fruit and vegetables. And what I loved about my grandparents' orchards was sort of this blend of this magnificent wild landscape, but also, you know, this is a very cultivated landscape as well. The orchards have just a very particular aesthetic. You know, this terrain is naturally, you know, it's on the eastern side of the Cascade Range, so it's drier. It's naturally drier and more arid than the western side. so, you know, in order to get the landscape to produce all this fruit, it has to be irrigated very heavily. And so it makes this sort of weird landscape where if you sort of go outside of the orchards, you know, it's very dry, and the orchards themselves are this sort of, you know, landscape under pressure, you know, to produce all of this fruit. And so I guess, you know, in some ways you can look at it as sort of a gross manipulation of the natural landscape. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, I grew up with that, and that's what I came to appreciate as being beautiful.
And tell us now a little bit more about your main character, Talmadge, because here is a man who comes into this wild landscape as a child and experiences some trauma as a child. He's orphaned at an early age. He has a sister who he loses. They create this orchard together, and then he loses her, a great mystery in his life. He seems to be a man of great compassion who is trying to create order out of wildness, not just in his orchard, but also among the people that he meets, these two young women.
Yeah, that was a big theme in the book. I mean, this sort of, you know, this presence of wildness that, you know, humans engage with in order to, for lack of a better word, as therapy, to sort of occupy themselves with and sort of learn, you know, from engagement with the earth, in Talmadge's case, you know, with his orchard keeping. There's also, you know, that theme is also present in the, you know, with the horses in the novel. And one of the characters, Della, one of the young women, becomes really interested in breaking horses. And, you know, that's sort of related, you know, sort of taking this really wild entity and trying to engage with it and force it to come under your control, for better or for worse.
And part of this wildness, I mean, there seems to be a connection to trauma also. I mean, mm-hmm. his own trauma in his life. And without any spoilers, I certainly don't want you to do that, but tell us a little bit about the trauma that is at the center of this book that brings these two young women to him in the first place.
I think the sort of trauma that every character shares, every one of the main characters anyways, is, you know, this experience of loss. You know, each character experiences a loss of a loved one at an early age. You know, and just speaking of those themes, you know, Talmadge is able to sort of engage with this wildness in a productive way, you know, where he's growing things and he's taking care of people in the book, whereas Della, you know, comes from, you know, she's experienced her own particular trauma of being abused at an early age and also experiencing, you know, loss in her family. So her interactions with the horses and with, you know, those people around her have a different feel, you know, compared to Talmadge. You know, her interactions are dangerous, and she's really searching for a way to sort of heal, but, you know, she's the one in the book who has the most trouble, I think.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story a tale that you spin there with her. She has a niece, her sister, who, you know, was with her, and we won't say how, but she gets out of the picture. Her sister gives birth to a daughter who is raised by Talmadge. Talk a little bit about Angeline and her character and what role that plays in the book.
Well, Angeline, you know, she's the one in the book, you know, she also experiences loss, but she is sort of couched, you know, in this orchard atmosphere and taken care of by Talmadge, which gives her a sort of different kind of life than everyone else has in the book. You know, she has someone there from the very beginning who cares for her constantly. And, you know, she has Talmadge, she has one single person, and so she develops this really special relationship with him. And, you know, he teaches her about orchard keeping, and she has this sort of idyllic life in the orchard, but she's haunted by the presence of, you know, what has happened in her family, and also, you know, the presence of Della, her aunt, haunts her, and I sort of go into that in the book. But, you know, it's sort of this, another theme that keeps, you know, recurring in the book is that, you know, everyone has sort of, you know, people and figures in their life and their family who sort of haunt them, and how do you deal with people who won't behave or interact nicely, you know, with you? What do you do about those characters?
It also brings up the whole role of compassion. I think I mentioned before that Talmadge is a man of great compassion. There is this twinning of tragedy and compassion in this book.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people have said that this book is really dark, and I understand and I recognize that darkness, but, you know, I also hope that people appreciate, you know, the moments where the bright moments of the book come from, you know, those moments of real communication between the characters and the relationship between the characters and either a passion that they have or the landscape itself, which I think is true in life. You sort of have these moments of connection with people or connection with the world in your own solitude. Those moments are very important. But, you know, there's this overarching presence of just hardship, which I think is very true to life.
There are some other figures, also a kind of a wise woman character in this book who I really loved, Carolyn Mitty. She is a friend of Talmadge's, but not really a lover. And in fact, he is a solitary man. So talk a little bit about Carolyn, and then also tell us why did you keep him such a loner? I mean, he would have been a misanthrope, except that he's not.
Well, I was interested in, you know, just this sense of his solitude. I mean, I really thought about his character, and I thought, you know, he's not a misanthrope. He isn't a grouch out there in the orchard. He just sort of enjoys being alone. He likes being out there working by himself, but he doesn't, you know, turn away the possibility of company. I mean, he doesn't create opportunities where, you know, he doesn't have big parties in the orchard or anything like that, but he has his couple of friends and he enjoys spending time with them, but he also enjoys retreating and doing his own thing. And I was interested in, you know, his and Carolyn Mitty's relationship because, you know, I thought one of the things that I really miss reading in literature and I don't see a lot is, you know, are those relationships between men and women that aren't sexual or romantic. You know, I miss sort of seeing friendships described in this really deep way, and I know that they exist in life, and so I don't know why they're not, you know, written about more. And so I was interested in creating this relationship that is very deep, excuse me, and important to each character, but, you know, never crosses any sort of sexual boundaries.
We're talking with Amanda Copeland about her debut novel, and it is a terrific one. It's called The Orchardist, and it's out from HarperCollins. You know, I hesitate to ask novelists about the connections between their own life and their fiction, but often debut novels do, you know, you write what you know, and they do draw on your own experience. And in this case, it was a little bit closer than it might be in many, at least according to the notes that were sent to me along with the book. And that is that there was an unspoken history of abuse in your own family. And I wondered if you might like to share a little bit about how that informed the writing of your book.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, as a child, when you're growing up, you know, certain children are I think all children are sensitive, you know, but if you are a particular kind of child, I think you're extra sensitive. And while you don't understand sort of the specifics of what can be going on, you know, in your extended family, you can sort of sense them. And I think, you know, growing up, you know, I have a very close, warm family that's sort of, you know, made up of people who are related by blood and people who have been sort of just, you know, thrown into the mix and, you know, by marriage or by adoption or just by, you know, being there by hanging around a lot. And I think it's a very, you know, I have a wonderful family. But, you know, when you, you know, every family is complicated and each, you know, person as an individual within a family has, you know, struggles and has demons. And I think, you know, the novel comes out of just, the, you know, the adult me trying to deal with sort of these tensions that I felt as a child. And when I was, you know, when I was small in the orchard, my sort of main concern was my grandfather, who had heart problems, and there was always this sort of possibility, you know, that he would become sick again. And so I was very, you know, I loved him very deeply, and I, you know, but I was always worried about him. And so, you know, I think that is at the sort of heart of the, you know, the genesis of the novel, is that I wanted to write about that sort of complex feeling I had being in this beautiful place and enjoying the natural landscape, but also being sort of emotionally tied up in knots, you know, and worrying about this person and worrying about, you know, my family, who I loved a lot and I knew who, you know, at different points were struggling.
And so you weren't just worried about him, but what you're saying is maybe some of your worry about him was also charged a little bit more because you knew that there were it says domestic violence and sexual and physical abuse going on somewhere in the family, but you didn't really know what it was. I mean, people have maybe said that this novel is dark, although I didn't find it dark, because it really does explore some very dark places in human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Even shocking places.
Right. I mean, you know, I think part of, you know, my feeling as a child was knowing that, you know, people had experienced these things, you know, people experience these things, you know, everywhere and every day. And I think that it was just my sort of, you know, that was a wound that the entire family shared, you know, and it was something that, you know, it's something you just have to sort of absorb, I guess, as an entire family, and that's what I'm trying to explain. It's as a child, you know, how do you absorb that? You know, it's sort of, you know, the book, in a way, I mean, this is a very peripheral, sort of crude way to describe the book, because the book, on one hand, doesn't have anything to do with me or my family personally. You know, there's nobody in the book who is specifically, you know, from my family or anything like that. But, you know, it is definitely a way, in writing a book like this, to sort of address what happened in one's childhood. How was one's psyche as a child influenced by sort of the unspoken things going on around her?
Yeah. And that really does affect Angeline as well. I mean, she's a very, you know, prepossessed young woman, feet strongly on the ground. And yet, you know, as much as Talmadge tries to protect her and keep her safe, she knows she can't be safe from everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly, I mean, you know, it's exactly what I was trying to say. I mean, just looking at the character of Angeline is sort of, she experiences in the book exactly what I just described, you know, as, you know, sort of a young child growing up in a family like mine. You know, Talmadge does his best to protect her and to give her this sort of safe, well-rounded environment. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, this is a very imperfect family. It's, you know, missing one of its key members who's running around causing all sorts of havoc. And, you know, they might not talk about it, but Angeline knows. You know, she doesn't know all the details, but she has this sort of sense, you know, that was just created in her just from her, you know, being in this particular family. And so she has to sort of deal with that legacy.
What I also found, and I want to tell our listeners that we're speaking with Amanda Copeland about her novel, The Orchardist. It is her first novel, and it is just absolutely terrific. Yet also, Talmadge takes enormous risks. While he protects Angeline, he's obsessed with Della. She's the one who got away. She's the one that he could not protect, and he cannot let that go.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
Well, I think, you know, he for sure he gets a little desperate you know, by the end of the book. I mean, there's this sort of progression of him slowly losing his common sense, you know, in the novel. And I think it comes from, you know, on sort of a strict psychological level, you know, very straightforward, is that, you know, he lost his little sister at an early age, not, you know, through death. I don't know if I can say this or not, if it's ruining anything in the book, but, you know, she disappears, and he never knows why or what happened to her, and that creates this sort of wound that will not heal in him. And so it sort of primes him to sort of have certain behaviors later in his life where these two girls are concerned.
Right. And my sense was really that he in order to heal, he had to try to bring Della back.
Yes.
You know, I also wanted to ask you, this is set at the turn of the last century. It's a very particular time and place. And talk a little bit about doing the historical research for this. I mean, it felt quite real. How was that for you? What did you do to find out how to make this, how to create the verisimilitude of this novel?
Well, growing up, I had, you know, members in my family. My grandmother, both of my grandparents and my mother, are huge Northwest history buffs. And so I grew up with sort of, you know, people talking about history all the time. And, you know, we would take road trips a lot as a family. And, you know, we were always stopping at historical markers. And, you know, all of us grandchildren would sort of groan, you know, because we were always stopping. But we learned a lot that way. And it was sort of, you know, I was sort of taught at an early age to value, you know, the history of where I was from. And so I imagined it, you know, a lot growing up. And, you know, I know that particular landscape with the orchards at a certain time period, you know, in the 80s and 1980s and beyond. But I started to wonder, you know, what was it like before people started coming in and, you know, started making these large orchards? You know, what was the landscape like? What would it have been like if you were the first homesteader in that region? And so I thought, you know, I'm gonna start thinking about this and writing about it. And I knew that when I was first visited by a vision of the book I wanted to write, that it was set at this particular time. And so I did do a lot of research. You know, I read a lot of books over the, you know, the 8 years it took me to write this novel, but I didn't have any sort of systematic way of researching. I just first and foremost let my imagination lead me, you know, to where I wanted to go. I would, you know, write scenes, and then, you know, if I had questions about, you know, historical details, then I would look them up. But I was really careful not to let it become a research heavy project, because I didn't want it to be a strict historical novel, and that, you know, I feel like there are literary novels that are set in the past, and then there are historical novels, which are, they can be literary, but they're also very interested in conveying sort of historical truth and being completely 100% accurate. Mm-hmm. And I feel like my book is not that, because I'm not as invested in that historical accuracy as other people who write historical fiction are. You know, I certainly don't want there to be mistakes or historical sort of discrepancies in my book. But I wanted all of those details to sort of reinforce the story I was trying to tell and no more.
Well, it was a terrific story, Amanda Copeland. It is called The Orchardist. It's a wonderful read, a great start to what I'm sure will be a very successful career as a writer. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you so much.
Amanda Copeland. You can read an excerpt from The Orchardist at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Rowan Jacobson about American terroir. Stay tuned after the break.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me. All the seven oceans, straight into the deep blue sea. She's as sweet as Tupelo, honey. She's an angel of the first degree. She's as sweet. She's as sweet as Tupelo, honey. Just like honey, baby, from the deep. You can't stop us on the road to freedom. You can't keep us, cause our eyes can see. Men within sight, men in granite.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ever since spending nearly a year living in a little village in southern France, I've been enamored of the idea of terroir, that special taste that place lends to local foods and wines. It's no accident that the notion has a French name, since the French are champions of terroir. In 1919, the French passed perhaps the first law protecting the place of origin for a given product. It's called AOC. Appellation. It covers things like wine, olive oil, and cheeses. Think, for example, of the Côte du Rhône label for wines. That covers a large region, but there are many AOCs that are much smaller. There's even one that covers only 10 acres of land. But you don't have to be French to appreciate the terroir of local foods and wines. My guest, Rowan Jacobson, has written a wonderful guide to American terroir. Part travelogue, part resource guide, and with recipes to match, Jacobson takes the eager locavore on a tour of regional specialties. Apples from Washington, maple syrup from Vermont, a smorgasbord of honey flavors from all different regions, and much more in his book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. Jacobson answers the question of why place matters. Why, for example, honey from the banks of the Apalachicola River tastes like cinnamon, and why many of the country's most intense cheeses are created in one underground cave in Vermont. Rowan Jacobson writes about food, the environment, and the connections between the two. His work has appeared in The Art of Eating, The New York Times, Outside Magazine, Harper's, and elsewhere. He's the author also of A Geography of Oysters, which earned the James Beard Award, as well as Fruitless Fall and The Living Shore. He lives in rural Vermont. American Terroir was published in 2010 by Bloomsbury. American Terroir, I just loved this book. Tell us first, what is terroir and what it isn't?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question, and depending on who you ask, you will get different answers. But as generally understood, terroir often gets translated as the taste of place, and it's about how the influences of an environment, of a particular place, show up in the taste of a food or a drink. So in France, it gets used to refer to various foods, but usually you hear it in association with wine, and it's a big part of understanding the character of a wine in France is understanding its terroir, the place that it comes from, and how that place changes the taste of the wine. But where you get into some interesting arguments is, you know, what you count as factors in terroir. Is it just the soil? Is it just the things that the dirt is doing to the grapes or to whatever other food is being grown? Or do you include the climate and the decisions made by the people who are growing food along the way?
And so what do you think?
I wrestled with this concept while working on the book. And what really defines terroir to me is it doesn't have to just be what you might call the chemical definition of terroir, like the different compounds in the earth that are affecting flavor, but anything that a place on earth is doing that is giving a cue to the plant itself or to the people growing the plant about what they should be doing to draw out the greatest flavor possible should count as terroir. So definitely the weather is a big factor in terroir. But if you look at France, the grapes that are now associated with particular regions were chosen over thousands of years of trial and error because they worked for that place because of the type of soil and the type of climate that that place had. So I feel like those types of decisions made by people are an important part of terroir.
One of the interesting things you say in your book, Rowan Jacobson, in American Terroir, is that stress is actually good, really helps to bring out the particular flavors of place. How does that happen? Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, that was one thing I hadn't thought about ahead of time, but as I was working on various foods in my book and looking for the, you know, the signal of terroir, it seemed like time and again, that's what came up, is that the tastiest foods and drinks don't come from plants that are just super happy and really pampered. That's been known for a long time in the wine world, but I was finding it in lots of other places too, like apples, a lot of fruits and vegetables, that's true for. And what I think is going on there is that flavor is all about different chemical compounds that are found in the plants. And the plants aren't putting those compounds into themselves to make themselves taste great. They are doing it usually as a response to some stress in their climate. If they're getting nibbled on by insects, they'll create all these natural compounds that are some sort of like a pesticide or are just meant to discourage insects from eating them because of the taste. That's part of the reason I think you can get more intense flavors from organic foods is because they're feeling the presence of those pests and they're responding by cranking up more of these chemical compounds that we humans have learned to really appreciate. And there's one that came up recently that interested me, and this actually isn't in my book, but I thought it was a fascinating example, is a lot of herbs in desert climates will have much more intense flavors because they try to protect themselves from the aridity and the sun by creating oils. And those essential oils that coat their leaves are where the nice flavor comes that we like. So oregano and mint and things from the desert have much stronger flavors.
Now, you mean this book, American Terroir, as a kind of sampler, and it gives the reader a wonderful combination of a kind of travelogue, a resource guide, and even some recipes that I can't wait to try out. These are all recipes that you've tried out?
Oh, yeah. I had to test them all.
It must have been a lot of fun to do this book. Let's start. You start with breakfast. You kind of go around through the day, and we start with breakfast with maple syrup. You point out that maple sugaring really can't be industrialized. It has to be done by small local producers. Why is that?
Maple sugar comes from maple sap, which is what's found in maple trees, and only during a very, very brief time of the year is it possible to get the sap that makes good syrup. And that's that first little stretch of late winter, early spring when the temperature is warm. It's at that point that the maple trees start, that the sap starts flowing through the maple trees. So you need a lot of maple trees to make any significant quantity of maple syrup. The number I usually see is that each tap on a tree will produce about a quart of maple syrup at best. So you need hundreds or thousands of trees just to make, you know, a few hundred gallons of maple syrup. So it doesn't work on a large scale level because there just aren't maple forests. You know, in order to be an industrial maple syrup maker, you'd have to own a maple forest the size of Vermont. Every 40 gallons of sap makes 1 gallon of maple syrup, because what you have to do is you take that sap, which only has 2 to 3% sugar in it, and then you boil it for hour after hour to get it down into that syrup. So it's incredibly energy intensive and labor intensive. So it's something that can only really be a labor of love. Like, no company in its right mind would decide to go into maple syrup.
Now, you call it the Church of the North Woods, these wonderful sugar shacks, and I know them well. I used to live right down the road from one of these, and You know, as you point out, they only operate, you know, at a very short period of the year. You went and you talked to one of the finest producers you found, Craig Line. He's a photographer by trade, but he also produces some of the best maple syrup. Tell us about him.
He's a great photographer, and he built a beautiful sugar shack not too far from my house, about maybe 5 miles away. And as I talk about in the book, it's just one of my favorite feelings in early spring is when the sugaring season starts and the sap starts to run. What happens is, you know, it's been cold winter in Vermont, and you've kind of been bundled up all winter, and everything is just white and still kind of dead outside. And there's, like, if looking around the landscape, you wouldn't see any signs that spring had started to stir. But there's invisible things that are happening, like the sap running in the maple trees. So you'll be driving along, and these sugar houses are like, they're kind of like the size of garages usually, but with peaked roofs and little cupolas on top that open up to let the steam out, because when you're boiling sap for hours, you make a hell of a lot of steam, so you got to let it out somehow. So you'll just be driving along your car, and then you'll see one of these sugar shacks with just an incredible amount of steam coming out the top of it and rising to the sky. And you know that's a sign that somebody's making syrup in there. And so there'll be lots of neighborhood parties, but even if there isn't one, you're usually, kind of the unwritten law is that you're welcome to stop by, and there'll be somebody in there, and you walk in, and it's almost like you walk into the rainforest, because you go from this cold, wintry world and into this little area that is has like a 80% humidity level, and is hot, and there's this bubbling syrup going, and people are handing out shots of syrup straight up, and mixing them with bourbon sometimes, and it's just a wonderful kind of communal atmosphere that is that first crop of the year.
And there are many flavors, many different flavors. I mean, not only the different flavors that come at different times, as you point out, the earliest is the clearest, fine quality, all the way down to the dark, which isn't any worse in quality, it's just later in the year and darker. But what makes the different flavors of maple syrup that comes from different places?
The taste of maple partly has to do with what time in the year you make it. And as you say, it gets darker and more intense as you go. So at first you have like a light caramel flavor, and then it gets much kind of smokier, more molasses like toward the end, and almost a little bit bacony sometimes. But then also, and this is something that the industry in Vermont is really just starting to understand and explore, the landscape will affect that flavor a lot. The type of bedrock that the trees are growing on, whether it's like schist or limestone, can actually have a big effect. And also whether the trees are growing down in, say, the Champlain Valley, where they kind of have richer soil to work with, or whether they're growing on top of a mountain where they've got really rocky soil. And one thing that I noticed is that the sugar bushes found on rocky mountaintops, this again goes back to that stress thing we talked about, they really they have a much harder time making sugar than trees in more comfortable environments. So their sugar level is actually lower. But then when you have to boil it more to get it to the 68% sugar level of maple syrup, you are then concentrating everything else that's in them that much more. So you get a lot more of the secondary compounds that contribute to that sort of wild maple flavor.
And that's one of the reasons you say that Craig Line's maple syrup. And what's the name of his company again?
Craig, he just usually goes by his name, Craig Line. There's another one called Dragonfly Sugar Works that I talk
the
one. About.
Dragonfly Sugar?
Yeah, Dragonfly Sugar Works, which is made by a guy named Paul Limberty, which is another a great syrup. And he's got a website, Dragonfly Sugar Works, and also sells at the Burlington, Vermont Farmers Market.
And his is kind of, his land, the trees are growing on a pretty steep slopes. And you say that's what you've just been talking about, the fact that they are more stressed is one of the reasons why you think his maple sugar is so good.
Yeah, definitely. It's got more of those secondary flavor compounds in it.
Climate change will eventually affect maple sugar production in New England. At the least, it will move maple forests up mountain slopes and further north. But Rowan Jacobson sees a more immediate threat: forests cut down by developers, loss of maple habitat.
The biggest challenge is just having forests of maple trees. So global warming is definitely an issue, but just loss of habitat is a bigger issue. And that's actually one of the amazing things about maple syrup is that it's a big part of the reason Vermont still has 85% forests, because it kind of helps forests pay for themselves. Like, if you can at least pay off your taxes and make a little bit of money from your forest through maple syrup, then you're less likely to cut it down and sell it off as lots.
Yeah, in fact, you say this whole concept of terroir is a way that connects us with the land and also then connects us with preserving it. It gives consumers also a reason, you know, foodie consumers a reason to preserve habitat.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like it's a way to value landscapes. Everything, basically, we live in a culture where everything comes down to a dollar figure. Like, that's how we know to evaluate value. And if people understand the amazing and unique things that a particular landscape can produce, and they come to value that, then that literally adds value to that landscape, and it's less likely to get converted into other things that we have a more traditional way of valuing, like home lots or, you know, building sites.
We're speaking with Rowan Jacobson about his new book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. And it's a wonderful read. Also, just beautifully written as well, as having just packed with good, flavorful information. Let's talk about apples. Here's also something that is grown in New England, but you went actually to the Yakima Valley of Washington State for apples. Why did you go there?
Washington State is our biggest grower of apples. Like, we tend to think of New England as being like perfect place for apples, and a lot of ways it is, but we can't compare with Washington State in terms of how easy it is to grow apples out there. Like, we have a very wet climate compared to the Yakima Valley, and so our apples tend to have a lot of scab on them and tend to get mildew issues and tend to have a lot of pests unless we use chemicals to stop that. But in the Yakima Valley is basically a desert. It gets something like 4 inches of precipitation a year, basically none. It's always sunny out there. And you could never normally grow an apple tree out there. An apple tree likes a fair amount of water, but it's all irrigated out there. So this is sort of an interesting spin on terroir, where sometimes people interpret terroir as you know, saying like no interference, right? Just let the landscape do what it can do. But here's a situation where they're using irrigation to do something the landscape never could have done, and to do something that we could never do here in New England, because when you give those trees all the water they need through irrigation, and they're getting sun all the time, and there's almost no impact of pests or fungi out there because it's so dry, you can get these organic apples that are just perfect and that grow incredibly easily, and also that really benefit from the huge diurnal swings in temperature, where you got hot days and cold nights, because a cold night is the signal to an apple tree to start to pump sugar into the fruit, because cold means fall is coming. So an apple tree will be sweeter if it gets cold nights and if it gets a lot of sun, because, of course, it uses that sun through photosynthesis to make the sugar in the first place. It'll also be redder, because the redness in apple skin is actually a form of natural sunscreen that it makes. So it's like just these dreamy apples, huge, perfect apples that come off the trees out there. And it's almost unfair to us, because, you know, we could never grow an apple like that. And you could also argue that our apples are going to have more interesting and varied flavors because of their, you know, their tough, hard-knock life here in New England. But it is pretty impressive to be out there and just see these, you know, red jewels on the trees.
And you point out that there used to be many, many more varieties than there are now. We almost went down to just a few, you know, Red Delicious and, you know, just a couple of others with the industrialized agriculture. But now organic apples are really gaining ground and we're getting different varieties of them. Talk a little bit about the varieties that are coming onto the market.
Yeah, it's a really hopeful time in the apple world. After this incredible loss of diversity from thousands of varieties, or even like 10,000 varieties to just maybe 100 varieties, and just a handful that were grown commercially, people really seem to have finally come around to appreciating diversity of flavor, which is something that, you know, you almost can't overemphasize what a surprising shift this was in the American palate after so long heading in the direction of industrialization and monoculture to suddenly be interested in diversity in terms of flavor. And New England is really just a genetic gold mine in terms of reviving the apple because, you know, as anyone knows who's driven around back dirt roads in New England, there are just apple trees growing all over the place. And every one of those is a potential for a new species because those wild apple trees are often formed from mothers and fathers that were abandoned varieties. So there's all this wild and crazy apple DNA lurking on the back roads of New England. And people are also learning to develop new varieties of apples that have much more interesting flavors than most of the ones that we grew up with, like the Red Delicious and the Golden Delicious. So you're getting apples like the Ambrosia and the Honeycrisp now, which have a lot of sweetness to them, but also a lot of acidity and a lot of crispness to them. They actually have smaller cells than a lot of the other apples like Red Delicious that have big cells that lead to kind of a mushy texture.
Another thing that has many different varieties is honey. And I just love this chapter, Rowan Jacobson, in your book, American Terroir. You point out, you know, this is something I really didn't know. I've seen wildflower honey, of course, and clover honey and sage honey. And I just always assumed that honey is honey is honey and all would taste pretty much the same. But you say not at all. Talk about some of the different flavors.
Yeah, boy, honeys can be all over the place, more so than almost any other food. And it all has to do with what the source of the honey is. Because to make honey, bees visit flowers, and they get the nectar, which is basically sugar water from the flowers. Then they take it back to their hive and condense it into a syrup, which is what honey is. So really, honey is as diverse as fruit is, because every single flower is going to have its own special mix of nectar that it makes. And those nectars all taste very different from each other. So if you taste, say, a chestnut honey, which is made from chestnut flowers, or versus an orange blossom honey, and then a clover honey, they're all going to be very different from each other. And we tend to, if you grew up with a little squeeze bear from the store, that was pretty much the mildest honey that could be had because the goal was to make a very, bland product that could be the same everywhere. But first thing I do when I go to a town I haven't been to before, I try to find the farmer's market and buy some local honeys because it'll kind of give you a really fun, immediate clue as to what that landscape is like and what some of the interesting things are that grow just there.
And not too far from Western Massachusetts is a place where you can sample honeys from all over the country and the world. You went to visit the Red Queen. Tell us about her and the time that you had there tasting the different honeys that she had.
That's a woman named Marina Marchese. And she doesn't have a retail shop, but she sells online and sells to a lot of stores in New York and elsewhere. So, you can order her honeys online. She usually has 20 or 30 varieties, and she gets them from all over. She gets some very interesting varieties. She's got some orange blossoms. Some are local New England honeys, and some are from much further afield. Tupelo is a really fascinating honey that she'll have, and you can also find it elsewhere. It's kind of a famous honey. You know, Van Morrison helped make it famous, but it was already famous before that as a very particular honey from the southeast that would never crystallize like some honeys can do. And it's only made from the tupelo tree, which is a tree that grows in the swamps in the Florida panhandle. I was actually just down there a couple of weeks ago visiting a man who makes maybe the only 100% tupelo honey in the world by taking a barge up the Apalachicola River in Florida and unloading his hives in these swamps. You can't drive to these places because it's so wet, but he has these little docks set up in the swamps, and he just takes all the hives up, puts them on the docks during the tupelo bloom, and so gets this honey that is made from nothing but tupelo flowers, because that's the only thing that the bees can find in these swamps.
Oh, do tell. Who is this?
His name is George Watkins, and you can find his honey online, too. It's amazing, amazing honey.
You say that some of the best honey you ever tasted was from Tokyo.
Yeah, which I hadn't expected. I was over there on a book tour, and it turns out there's something called the Ginza Honey Project, which makes honey right in downtown Tokyo. Ginza is kind of that center section of Tokyo. And the honeybees, I think, are mostly... Bees can actually do quite well in urban environments, and you're seeing a big revival of beekeeping in places like New York City, because there's usually people are growing a lot of flowers, and so the bees have lots of sources of nectar. And usually there actually aren't that many pesticides used in truly urban environments. So bees can do well there. And the ones in Tokyo were doing really well. And I actually think they were getting a lot of their nectar from the Emperor's Palace, which is right in downtown Tokyo also, and is this huge natural area with lots and lots of gardens for the bees to choose from. So it was this beautiful light honey made right in downtown Tokyo.
Oh, that's marvelous. You actually, though, say that the honey made in the U.S. is some of the tastiest. Tell us about cat claw honey. Where is this from?
Yeah, there's a number of desert honeys that come from the Southwest that have really unusual flavors. Some good, some bad. There's a mesquite honey that's really good. There's cat claw. There's certain towns down there that have very strong honey traditions, and you don't really learn about them in the rest of the country. But, you know, they'll be locally famous for these honeys that are a unique product on Earth because they'll be working with some, you know, wild shrub like the cat claw that just has its own flavor. And to me, it's just like a really, really special and undervalued food that is the kind of thing that if you didn't pay attention to and that whole area got turned into subdivisions, it would be a great loss and not enough people would notice.
And then goldenrod honey. This is something that allergy sufferers hate, the goldenrod, but when you went to visit Marina Marchese, she brought out her goldenrod honey very proudly.
Yeah, I love goldenrod honey. It's one of my favorite. I've had some meads made with goldenrod honey up in Quebec that were my favorite meads ever. It's a very strong flavored honey. It's a really important one for the bees, too, because, well, as we know, in the fall, it's one of the last flowers blooming en masse, so it provides them with a really important source of food right before winter hits.
And we could not end this interview without talking about cheese. You're up in Vermont. You talk about the washed rind cheese of Vermont. Tell us about that, and tell us, how do you make milk rot right?
I'm glad you asked. Yeah, you know, cheese is basically rotten milk, but it's got to be the right kind of rotten milk. The age-old way of making cheese is to take the milk, get a lot of the water out of it by curdling it, and then you've got basically what's like fresh farmer's cheese, and then you just let it start to decay. And there are zillions of microscopic organisms in the air that will help take care of that process for you. But you wouldn't want just anyone to do it. There are certain ones that make it decay nicely and certain ones that don't. So what cheesemakers have always learned to do is to either add the correct organisms to the fresh cheese to age it, or to just set the conditions so that the right natural organisms will age it for you. And that's what happens with washed rind cheese, is the cheesemakers take like a brine and wash the cheese in this brine, so it's got a really salty surface. And there are only certain organisms that can survive that salty surface, and one of them is the type of bacteria responsible for making stinky cheese. And it's perfectly safe to eat, but it's definitely stinky. So by washing the rind all the time, the cheesemakers encourage this sort of bright orange bacteria to grow on the rind, and that's what gives some of those super strong cheeses like Münster its characteristic flavor. And there's a cheesemaker I'm quite fond of here in Vermont who does that using these natural bacteria that are in the air. And also, instead of just using a plain brine, they actually use a salted beer that their neighbor makes. So that adds another little extra bit of unique local terroir to the flavor of the cheese.
And that's Matteo Kaler?
Yeah, he's a cheesemaker, and it's called Jasper Hill Farms.
Yeah, they've gotten a lot of praise from, I don't know if it was best in show, but pretty high up there in cheese competitions.
Yeah, they've won quite a few, and yeah, they've become a big deal. They actually have these amazing aging facilities that are built right into a hillside here in Vermont, and they make maybe six or seven different fantastic cheeses now. They also work with a lot of small farms in Vermont and New Hampshire, because part of their mission isn't just to make great cheese, but to keep these working rural landscapes alive by giving these small farmers a way to support themselves.
In your book, American Terroir, you also talk about chocolate and wine and mushrooms and coffee. We don't really have the time right now to talk about those, but I wanted to ask you, you ranged all over North America. You went to Canada. You went down to parts of Central America even. What's the most important thing you learned while doing this book?
To try to not approach a food with like preconceptions. We tend to learn only one style of a particular food, and then we think that's how that food is supposed to be. And usually that food is made in all kinds of different ways all over the world, in ways that are totally interesting and valid, but don't get much attention because they don't fit into the specs that have been created for that food. So that's one thing I learned, is that there's a much wider variety of flavors out there than we think there are.
Well, this was a delicious book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. It's got recipes, it's got resources. It's a wonderful book to read, and thank you so much, Rowan Jacobson, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca. It's been a pleasure.
Rowan Jacobson is also the author of A Geography of Oysters, The Connoisseur's Guide to Oyster Eating in North America, Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis, and The Living Shore. His work has been included in the Best American Science and Nature Writing and Best Food Writing collections. American Terroir was named as one of the top 10 books of the year by Library Journal in 2010. His latest book is Shadows on the Gulf, A Journey Through Our Last Great Wetland. Go to writersvoice.net for links to some of Rowan Jacobson's articles. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.